enters a beauty contest and becomes queen of the greatest empire in the world at that time. Through her position, she's able to save her people, the Jewish people, from annihilation because there's a man named Haman who is plotting to destroy them. And through her influence with the king, she's able to save her people. What I'd like to do this morning is not to look at any single text, any single passage involving this story, but I like to sort of maybe zoom out and look at Esther as a person from really 10,000 feet up. You know, when you preach a series like this, you have to think a lot about the person, and so you find yourself every day meditating on the individual. So I really love my wife, but I've been thinking about Esther now for 3 or 4 weeks, more than my wife. And as I've thought about her and thought about the things that happened and the situation that she found herself, particularly the culture that she lived in, it seems to me that there are some things that are very applicable to you and I, because it seems to me that some of the things that she faced, maybe you face, maybe more so as a woman than obviously as a man. And so I'd like to talk to you about some of the things that if Jesus had talked to Esther, what would he have said to her? And it seems to me that there were multiple things. Because I'm a preacher, there'll be three, of course. But it seems to me the first thing that Jesus might have said to Esther, as you reflect on her, is that, Esther, you need to find your value in me rather than your beauty. I think if Jesus had a conversation with Esther, one of the things that he would have said, again, is, Esther, you hit the genetic lottery. You're very beautiful. But even at that, you need to find your value in me rather than your beauty. I mean, if you think about Esther, she lives in a very beauty-driven culture, doesn't she? When the king wants to find a wife, he doesn't try to find the smartest woman in the world. He doesn't try to find the person who is most compatible with him. But he goes out and he has a beauty contest. And really, if you think about the Persian culture as we've looked at it in this book, what are men judged on? Essentially by the size of their wallet, right? Because really, why is the king having a party and it's a 180-day party for all of his friends? What's he trying to prove to all of his friends by throwing a 6-month party and just drinking the finest wines and just having a 6-month vacation? What's the point that he's trying to make? I'm really rich. That's what he's trying to make. I'm a great man because I'm a wealthy man. But again, what's the women judged on? They're judged primarily on their beauty, primarily on their appearance, right? That's the whole point in him choosing Esther. Now, it's easy to look at the culture and say, what a terrible culture. Men are judged on the size of their wallet. Women are judged on the size of their dress. What a horrific culture to have to grow up in. Isn't it great that things have now changed and things are so different? And you're right. I mean, it would be terrible to live in a culture, for instance, where if you go through the line of the grocery store, 90% of the images are of women whose bodies have been digitally engineered to look in a way that 99% of the women could never look. It's a digital thing. It's computerized. It'd be awful to live in a culture like that, wouldn't it? It would be awful to live in a culture where cosmetic surgery is a multi-billion-dollar industry, wouldn't it? It'd be terrible to live like that. It would be terrible to live in a culture where you can't even get a job reading the news on TV unless you look like a supermodel. It'd be terrible to live like that, wouldn't it? It'd be terrible to be judged on your dress. It would be terrible to live in a culture where essentially the perfect size is so emphasized by the media that 92% of the women who are polled consider themselves to be overweight due to the body images that are portrayed in the media. It'd be terrible to live like that, wouldn't it? Of course, you know, you do live like that. And beauty is emphasized and it is pushed on the fairer sex. Why? Naomi Wolf, who's a feminist, says, well, essentially the reason why beauty is, or an ideal of beauty, really an unattainable view of beauty is so pushed, she said it's essentially a conspiracy of the diet, the cosmetic alterations, it's not the right word, I think, but cosmetic industry and the cosmetics, makeup, hairspray, yada, 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 the beauty industry. It's really all of those industries getting together and shaming women so that they'll buy their products. And there's probably something to that. I mean, it isn't the best interest of multi-billion dollar companies that you feel bad about yourself so that you'll run down and buy what they have to offer to make you look prettier. There is a conspiracy there. But you know what? It probably goes deeper than that. Because in Persia, you didn't have those multi-billion dollar industries, and still beauty was essentially the way that a woman was valued. Now you have it today and you can say it's a conspiracy, but you know what? It really is deeper than that, isn't it? There is something innate in human beings that says beauty matters. Looks are the most important thing. I mean, think about it like this. How many people have you ever heard say, you know what, I shouldn't have dated them because they weren't my body type. I didn't find them physically attractive, but they were so nice. They were so sweet. I probably shouldn't have dated them, but I did anyway. Nobody ever says that. They always say, I don't know what I was thinking. They weren't that nice of a person, but I dated them because they were just so good looking. I mean, I would have never introduced them to my mother, but they were so pretty. It's a looks-driven culture. Even in the church, you know, you'll have people say, well, I would love to meet a nice Christian. Well, you say that, but you mean that on the second cut. Because when you walk into a room and you immediately eliminate 75% of the people, you eliminate 75% of the people based on appearance, not personality. And you might are looking for a great Christian on the second cut, but the first cut is always on looks. Always is. Why is that? Why is there this innate thing? I mean, the older you get, you have to keep reminding yourself, I must not judge people on the outer appearance. I know the Bible says man looks on the outer appearance, but God looks at the heart. I shouldn't judge people on how it looks, but the very fact that you have to remind yourself of that means that it's innately there. Why is it there? I think this is why. I think there's multiple reasons, but the reason why it's there is because innately we believe that the outer reflection, or the outer person is a reflection of the inner person. Innately, we believe that. That the outer tells us what's on the inner. We took our girls on Halloween trick-or-treating a couple of years ago. And at that point, Livy was 4. And so Ava's running up. She's with the kids. They're going to all the houses. But Livy's hanging out. She's got like a Reese cup and a Tootsie Roll in her thing. And everybody else is starting to fill up. But I notice her walking there. And I said, honey, go with the kids. Go get your candy. And she said, I'm only going to the pretty houses. Now, why would a 4-year-old be sitting there standing in the street saying, you know, I'm not going to that house. It's missing some shingles. They need to paint the thing. They at least could work on the shrubs a little bit. I'm not going to an ugly house. I'm only going to the pretty houses. By the way, she only had 2 pieces of candy. She wasn't doing so well. Why would she do that? Because she's afraid of strangers. And she watches Disney movies. And the witches always live in the ugly houses, and the nice princesses always live in the pretty houses. And she thinks that at 4 years old, you can judge the character of a person based on the paint job on their house. It's innate, isn't it? It's in there. Think of it negatively. If you see a guy sitting on a park bench and he's out of shape, however you define out of shape, and his hair's a mess, and he's got this red stain on his t-shirt from where he ate spaghetti earlier and didn't even clean it off, and he's just sitting on the park bench slouched, it's really hard for you to believe he's got it all together on the inside, isn't it? You just look at it and say, he cannot have it together on the inside if he can't get it together on the outside. There's no way that guy is smart, intelligent, successful, brilliant on the inside when he looks like he's a wreck on the outside. Just human nature to say that. If you see a guy and at least everything's ironed and the hair's in the right place and he's trying and he's it seems like he's making an effort. It's easier to believe that he might have it together on the inside. But again, you have to know that, maybe the guy on the park bench that looks like a disaster really does have it together. That happens, but you have to tell yourself that because instinctively you don't believe it. We believe that together on the outside means together on the inside. We mean that pretty on the outside means pretty on the inside. Just easy to believe there's something innate there in us. And all the evidence says it's not true. But there's something deep inside of us that from the age of 4... we believe that it is true. Man does look on the outer because he thinks the outer reflects the inner. And I think that Jesus would just look at Esther and say, honey, again, you hit the genetic jackpot. Everybody isn't blessed like you. But society values you based on your appearance, but don't you value yourself based on your appearance? Because you know what? Appearances change. Bible says charm is deceitful and beauty fades. If your value on yourself is the same that the culture's value is on you, your value on yourself is going to decline as gravity and the sun does its damage, as nature robs you of your beauty, your value is going to decline. You can't value yourself on that basis. I mean, what are you going to do? Have cosmetic surgery every 3 years? I mean, are you going to look like, Joan Rivers when you're 70 and you can't feel your face? And what are you going to do? But rather, Esther, if you'll value yourself because I died for you on the cross, that puts the value on you. That puts the price on you that God was willing to die for you. That's how valuable you are. That value won't change. That value won't change. Don't fall into the trap of being consumed by your beauty. Don't fall into the trap of being consumed by your lack of beauty. Fall into the trap of believing Jesus Christ died for you and you won't have to be concerned at all about your appearance. Not what the basis of your worth is. I think second of all, Jesus would have looked at Esther and maybe said something like, and Esther, remember, to make my will your mission rather than be driven by your ambition. In other words, make my will your goal in life and not your personal ambition. Because see, it really, if you think about Esther, she was confronted with the typical confrontation of, do I want a career or do I want love, right? And Esther chose career. I mean, listen, when she entered that beauty contest, she wasn't getting married for love. That's not what it was about. Her husband Xerxes had 400 wives. You don't marry a man with 400 wives because you think you're going to ride off. He's going to divorce 399 wives and you're going to ride off together in the sunset. That's not what it's about. You marry a man with 400 wives because you want to live in the palace and have lots of servants. That's why you do it. It was a career move. Wasn't about love with Esther. She chose career over love. If she wanted to have been married for love, she'd have married the town blacksmith or a farmer and lived happily ever after and watched the grandkids play in the backyard. That's not what she did. She wanted to live in a big house and have lots of servants, and the way to do that is to marry it. She chose career. I remember reading a biography, or maybe it was an article, about Jackie Kennedy, who was married to President Kennedy. And the individual knew Jackie, and she said, you know, people admired Jackie for putting up with President Kennedy's endless number of adulteries. I mean, he had, what, now they say what, there were at least three secretaries that worked as sort of his concubines in the White House. He had an affair with Judith Campbell, who was also having an affair with Sam Giancana, who was the head of the Chicago Mafia. He also had an affair with a woman who was later revealed to be a Russian spy, which in our culture today might have caused him some issues. There was also Marilyn Monroe, and there was many, 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 many others. And people say, how could Jackie be such a loving, dedicated wife to a man who was a chronic adulterer? And the person who knew Jackie said, see, if you ask that question, you don't understand. She said, Jackie Kennedy grew up in the New England socialite scene. Her dad was just like John Kennedy. In the New England socialite scene, the rich men were very entitled. And so John Kennedy's dad had lover stash all over the country. And Ted and Bobby and Jackie's dad. She said, those men had a great sense of entitlement. Everybody knew that that they had lovers stashed all over town. You didn't marry a Kennedy for love. You married a Kennedy for power, prestige, and money. And you have your children, and he does his thing, and he's kind to you, and he gives you $100,000 a year to go buy clothes so you look good on TV standing next to him, and he lets you go on great and wonderful vacations while he does his thing, and he lets you raise his children, and you get power, money, and prestige. That's the way it was. Jackie Kennedy knew what she was marrying, and so the affairs didn't bother her. That was already factored in. It was a career move. It wasn't for love. And that's Esther. It's a career move. There's this ambition that says, this is what I want to do. This is what I'm going to accomplish. This is what I'm going to be. And really, if you think about it, that's what the culture in many ways tells you, that you ought to be that way. You ought to be an ambitious, driven person. Really, if you think about what does it mean to be a hero in the 21st century? To be a hero in the 21st century means that you throw off all weights and you pursue your ambitions and your goals blindly. That's really what it means to be a hero in our culture. I mean, think about two of the great heroes of the last 50 years. Remember Sound of Music? Terrible movie. Remember what the Maria doesn't sing the song, but the mother sings the song to Maria, which is really Maria's words, where she's at. How does it go? Climb every mountain, ford every stream, follow every rainbow until you find your dream. Ford every mountain, follow every dream, something. Follow every rainbow until you find your dream. Now, you think about that. You realize that in that scene where she's telling her, go climb the mountain, ford the stream, follow the rainbow, find your dream. You realize, I don't want to bum you out on the movie, you realize she's breaking her word to the Lord because she made a lifetime vow to be a nun, and she's reneging on God But that's okay if you're going to chase your rainbows. Go ahead and renege on God. Go chase the rainbow. You met a man, and that's more important than your promise to God. I don't want to ruin the movie for you. I'm just being a little negative about the whole thing. I would have done the same thing. He was rich, and you know, but no. I wouldn't have wanted the 8 kids, though. How many kids? 8 or 10? Yeah. Rich, 8 kids. That's sort of iffy, isn't it? But anyway, but that's the goal. Think about the other heroine. Let it go, let it go. Let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're gonna say. Let the snow rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway. Something like that. Think about that. Just let it go. I'm going to go out tired of what people think about me. I'm tired of doing what I want. I'm tired of being told what to do. I'm going to go out and I'm going to pursue my dreams, and I don't care what they think anyway. Of course, again, it's a lousy story, because in pursuing her own dreams, Elsa sits off the eternal winter and ups everybody's power bills. But that's the negative side. She's a very self-centered person. In pursuing her dreams, she causes all of this damage. But I mean, she's pursuing her dreams. Marie is pursuing her dreams. And that makes them heroes. But here's the thing. Here's the thing with personal ambition. Here's the thing with chasing your rainbows. That's the problem. At your core, you're a deeply conflicted person, which means you are always chasing at least 2 rainbows. And you can never really decide on which rainbow you really want. Left to yourself, you're a deeply conflicted individual. And that's why people who say, I'm going to go out, I'm going to pursue what I want, end up doing 6 different things and end up very disappointed. They end up being a fruitcake on Facebook, and you're listening to them, and it's like, oh, They're all about being a mother now, because 2 months ago they were all about getting a degree, and 2 months ago it was all about their career, and 2 months ago it was all about a man. What are they doing? They're chasing their rainbows. And see, again, at your core, you're deeply conflicted, and that's why your ambition is going to cause you great trouble, because think about it this way. Do you want to make a lot of money, or do you want to have a lot of deep, meaningful relationships? The answer is yes. Do you want freedom, or do you want to be in a loving, committed relationship with a person of the opposite sex? The answer is yes. But you can't have both. If you want to have a love, committed relationship, it costs you your freedom. I mean, think about it. Do you want to travel and see the world? Do you want to live with a sense of adventure, or do you want stability in your life? The answer is yes. Do you want to eat whatever you want and live a long life? The answer is yes. You can't do both. And at the core of your heart, you're always deeply conflicted. You do want the relationships, but you also want to accomplish these goals, and they counter each other. You do want freedom, but you also want a level of commitment that can only come with abandoning that commitment. You do want abandonment, but you also want stability. At your heart, you are a deeply conflicted person, and when you say, I'm going to pursue my rainbows, there's always 2 or 3 or 4, and you'll never be able to center on one. You're going to bounce from one to the other, and in the end, you're not going to get anything. You'll never find the pot of gold. And I think Jesus would say to Esther, you know what? Your ambition's nice, but if you don't make my will, Jesus said, actually, he said, I come to do the will of the Father. And then he called people to follow him. So really, if you don't center your life on the will of the Father, and if that doesn't become the core driving force of your life, you're going to be a deeply sorrowful person in the end. And be deeply sorrowful in the end, because the rainbows always disappoint you. Even when you get them, they disappoint you. They're not what you thought that they were. But if you can center your life on the will of God, you know what? You can go through different chapters of your life. And I may be working, and I may be a mother at this moment. I may be a homemaker. I may be back maybe in my career. I may be giving time and volunteer efforts, but the goal has always been the same, to do the will of the Father. Whether I'm at home or in my marriage, or whether I'm in a career, or whether I'm on a college campus, I'm always really about the same thing. It's always the same rainbow, to do the will of the Father. And that's, again, how you keep from getting conflicted. I hope Esther found that, by the way. Because if you go to the history of the Persians, she was probably 18, 19 when she married the king. 15 years after she married him, he was assassinated at the age of 53. He was killed. So that puts her 33, 34, maybe, without a husband. There isn't any heirs that came from Esther that we're aware of, so there were no children from that relationship. Another wife produced a son named Darius, and Darius began to rule, and he would have picked his own queen. He would have chosen his own feminine company. And so at that point, Esther would have been maybe 34, 35, no children from that relationship. She might have been given a villa out in the country to go spend her days. I hope she was able to curb her ambition, because at the age of 35, she was essentially retired with no children. Now, I don't know what happened. She might have married another man. She might have done, we just don't know. There's no history there. But I hope that being the queen and living in the palace and having lots of servants wasn't the full extent of her life. Because if it was, the last 40 years of her life must have been very miserable. One other thing. I think Jesus would have said, again, you need to make my opinion of you the basis of your value, not your beauty. Although culture is going to do that to you, don't do that to yourself. You need to make my Father's mission your fundamental mission in life, or you're going to chase one rainbow after another and you're going to be very disappointed in the end. I think thirdly, he would have said to her, and you need to make me the basis of your peace and contentment, not the opinion of the king. If you think about this story, the greatest threat to the peace and contentment and happiness of Esther is the king, right? Because he's the king, but he's got lots of other wives. And remember when Mordecai comes to her and says, you got to go talk to him. What does she say? He hasn't seen me in 30 days. I hope that the king's opinion of her wasn't so great that for 29 days she wasn't sitting there feeling rejected and spurned and feeling unloved. I hope that all of her eggs weren't in his basket. Because see, if you think about it, if you're an uncontented or discontented person who doesn't have an inner sense of peace or contentment or any great degree of happiness, even though you may call yourself a Christian, let's just be real. You may call yourself a Christian, but you say, you know, I'm not really happy now. I don't have a sense of peace. I don't have a lot of contentment. When life gets bad, it gets really bad inside of me. If you're that kind of person, there's only about three things it can be. The first two are a small minority. Well, one of them is you got something chemically going on with your body that might need to be addressed with some medicine. There's some mood imbalances that medicine might help. It could be a chemical issue. It could also be a traumatic issue. There are things in your past that keep coming up and reoccurring and bringing themselves into your memory, and there's some trauma there. And that may very well take some therapy. We're talking about things like PTSD and sexual abuse and those things that come to mind that can really rob you of your joy until you at least maybe learn some coping mechanisms there. But the vast majority of people who are discontented and are unhappy and are lacking peace, it's because they don't feel admired, they don't feel accepted, they don't feel loved. And the problem with that is this: if you don't feel accepted and loved or respected or even valued as a person, it's very hard to be contented and peaceful and happy in your life. But there's a hitch. Because essentially the person who is going to make you feel admired and loved and valued. It's only going to be one person or maybe one group of people. See, let me put it this way. If you're a guy and you go to work and everybody at work thinks you're a great person, you don't have an enemy at work. Everybody thinks you're a wonderful person, but you love and admire your wife and she thinks you're a bum. You know what you'll feel like? You'll feel like a bum. If you have a father, and maybe you're in high school, and man, you're a gridiron hero. Everybody loves you. I mean, people want to date you. Everybody wants to be your friend. I mean, you're great at work. But you admire your dad, and he thinks you're a failure. You know what? You won't be a happy person. You have to be admired by the person you admire most. You have to be respected by the person you respect. You have to be loved by the person that you love. You have to be valued by the person that you value most. And if you don't get that, you're not going to have peace or contentment in your heart. It's that vital. And I don't know many of you, and so let me just throw out some scenarios. Maybe your mom was a single mom. And she's your hero. She raised you without the help of a man, and she was dedicated to you, and she was faithful to you, and you grew up saying, man, my mom was the strongest woman I know. She's my hero. But you're 20, 25, and funny thing about your mom is she is your hero, but she's very moody. And sometimes she's very distant from you, and sometimes you feel a lot of rejection from your mom. Sometimes she's maybe very controlling in your life, and if you don't do it her way, then you feel her wrath. You know what? You're going to be a very discontented person, because the person who you admire the most will shape your self-opinion of yourself more than even what the culture thinks of you, i.e. the beauty. And it's going to be very hard for you to be a happy, contented person when you don't feel admired, valued, or respected. And that's got to come from the person that you admire the most. And if you're the queen, the man that you admire, the man that you value, the man that you esteem most is the king. And he wants to see you about 10 times a year. That's what he thinks of you. It's going to be impossible to be happy or contented or at rest. And I think what Jesus then would say to Esther is this, and you know where I'm going with this. I think what Jesus might have said to Esther is this. Esther, if you could come to the place where you truly admired me above everybody else, where you truly valued me above everybody else, where you truly loved me above everybody else, where I was first in your heart and in your affections, Esther. You got to understand that you could probably be a contented, happy person because my love for you does not change. I'm not the king. I'm not the mother who's distant from you. I'm not the father who's distant. I'm not the wife who you can't please. I'm not the husband who it's never good enough for. And he loves you about half the time and he rejects you about half the time. So you're happy about half the time. My feelings for you change not. And if you would admire me and love me and value me, if I was really first in your heart, your contentment and peace in difficult times would actually be very, very secure, because my love does not vary. It does not change. My admiration for you is set. I loved you so much that I died for you. That's set. That's written in stone. And it doesn't matter what you're going through, the person that you will admire and value and love the most will love and value you the most. And your happiness, your best chance of happiness will be secure. I think that Jesus would say these things. Esther, don't let the culture define you. Don't let the culture put its values on you. It values you because you're beautiful, but don't you buy into that. You value yourself because of what I've done for you. Esther, Do not allow your ambition to run rampant, because the rainbows that you choose will be multiple and they will always leave you feeling empty. But those who do the will of the Father and base their life around God's plan for their life, the rainbow is attainable. Nestor, whatever you do, esteem me, value me, put me above everyone else. Esteem me, because in doing that, you're allowing me to define you. And as I define you, you can have peace and contentment. But if you allow others, if you esteem others more highly than me, then you're giving them the power to define your own image. And you're never going to be happy or contented for a long period of time like that. Again, I think that's what Jesus would say to Esther. Maybe today you're going through a difficult problem. You can stand. I realize that was a mouthful and you're still saying, what did he just say? What's he talking about? Go home and think about it. Maybe you're going through a difficult place in your life. You know what the Bible says? I just read it, James 4:6. It says that God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Whatever you're going through today, I'll tell you what you need. You need grace from God. Just need grace. Maybe you're working hard to put together a relationship and you seem like you're the only person who's trying to keep that relationship together. You just need grace. You need more of God. You need more help from God. Maybe you have decisions you have. Maybe your body's turning against you. It's a whole host of things you might be facing that might cause you to say, you know what, I'm just going to walk down and I'm going to humble myself and I'm going to ask God to give me grace to get through this place in my life. Hey, maybe you're a mother today and the kids weren't lying and they're driving you crazy. You say, I need grace as a mother. Come to the Lord. The Bible says he'll resist the proud. If you want to stand there and act like you ain't got no problems, that's fine. He'll resist you. If you'll humble yourself, he'll give grace to the humble. Let's sing together.